Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself.
We spent some time visiting with the man who used to build bikes for third world victims of landmine explosions. Rod Miner of Lightfoot Cycle, one of this nation's greatest bike builders, thanks to the internet, has been able to keep the purity of his purpose alive. From a tiny Montana town of 1,500 people, Rod has been able to flourish in satisfying his goal of supplying people all over America and the world with transportation that is reliable, highly efficient, and highly capable. Okay, Rod, so how you doing today, guy?
Well, I'm doing good. Thank you for asking.
Right, Rod. Awesome. I can't wait to talk about Lightfoot Cycle. I really can't. This is going to be fun. I know from our conversations over the years that I'm always amazed at who you are and how you do what you do. And let's kind of see if I can't share that excitement with my listeners.
Sounds good.
Rod, before you became Lightfoot Cycle, your retired airplane mechanic father designed a trike for amputee victims of bomb explosions. Was it you and your dad that then built the volunteer organization that would go on to manufacture and distribute them to third world countries?
My dad prototyped the PET hand cycle, and I developed it for manufacture. It was the first project of what was to become Lightfoot Cycles. And we worked with an organization he was already affiliated with, a Christian organization out of Columbia, Missouri, to actually develop it into a what would become an international organization.
Huh.
The PET project, P-E-T, is an acronym that stands for personal energy transportation, allowed people who had lost their mobility because of landmine explosions and, of course, a number of other reasons, to be able to get around in rough and rugged conditions in developing areas of the third world where there are no sidewalks, there are no accessibility statutes. It's either crawl around or be carried, or in this case use your own personal energy to transport yourself in this simple little rugged hand cycle.
Okay, so it sounds to me like it's and I've seen actually at your website in the video, it's a little wooden trike. Is that not correct?
It is made of a metal frame, which we would create, and then it's finished with wood that is supplied by people who are receiving it, or the organization that is going to receive it, let's say in Chad or Cambodia or some other war-torn area. And they do the woodwork, and they can maintain that woodwork, the wood superstructure that creates the seat and the cargo area. And it's all underlaid with this metal, this very durable, simple metal frame.
I see. And the tires look like they were pretty pretty heavy duty.
The tires are, are definitely heavy duty. And at this time, the PET project, which now goes under the name of the giftofmobility.org group, is actually having donated to them a polyurethane-filled, flat-proof wheelbarrow tire. Very durable, the kind of thing that fits with the idea, we gift this vehicle to you, it is designed to last for a lifetime. It's the only one you will ever get. Take good care of it, and it'll take care of you.
And people all over the world are involved in some aspect of PET production. Can you tell me how many different parts of the world that would include?
There are over a dozen.
A dozen, okay.
Localities now.
Okay. All right. And that also by 2009, something like 15,000 of them have been produced. Of that number, how many of those would you say that Lightfoot Cycle has made?
Well, we just made the first 500 or so. And what we did was we decided that because we are necessarily a for-profit organization, we are trying to support ourselves, we would get more cycles to more deserving people if we could lower the cost. And we lowered it as far as we could, and we were, my family and I were barely making it, but we knew that we needed to keep the cost low in order to have this project do what it was intended to do, which was to deliver as many cycles as possible to people who needed them, who are a heck of a lot worse off than we. So what we did was we broke the design down into all of its component parts. We drew up mechanical drawings of the parts and would create a package of a sample part with a mechanical drawing, and we started sending it out to people who had volunteered to help, or organizations that said we may be able to find people to help. And after a while, we had this network of people. A typical person would be like a retired machinist someone like that, who could go out into their shop, order one kind of material, use a little bandsaw and a little drill press, and create this part. They were then all shipped from all these disparate locations to a central staging area in Columbia, Missouri, where the pieces were all brought together and boxed up and sent out as a kit.
So essentially, I think what I'm hearing is that you fabricate a design for the actual component, each component, for the machine, and then went out and had them made all over the nation by different satellite operations, and then they send them to Columbia. Is that correct?
That is correct, and this is still the case. A network of volunteers are making this virtual manufacturing facility.
Wow. So there would be no PET if there was a PET that involves such a nationwide operation of builders if it weren't for Rod Miner.
Or for my dad, or for Mel West, the guy who spearheaded the organization. And, of course, the goodwill of all the people who said, this sounds like a good idea. We want to help. And I think the thing that triggered it for a lot of people was visual and spoken images of the people that we were helping. The first, one of the first people to receive a PET was a woman who crawled 3 miles through the dirt to the distribution point, dragging her legs behind her with her two toddlers, 3 and 5 years old, walking along behind her through the morning dew, through the dust. This woman had lost her standing in the village, and that's not a pun. It's a horrible pun if it is one. But she could no longer maintain a job. She could no longer, she couldn't get married. Her husband abandoned her. And this is the case with a lot of these people. They are in a poor area, and all of a sudden, boom, you can no longer walk. You're now a burden on your family. You're not a producing member of society. And this is the experience. And the experience of helping these people is what underlays everything that Lightfoot does. We're trying to get our cycles to people who will find them to be of value to them. And anytime we can help people out with one of our adaptive cycles or a working cycle, then those are the days when we really feel we've accomplished something.
Jeez. Well, you know, you started riding Recumbents back in, I think, 1983. Pretty much about the same time I did. And then 13 years later, in 96, you started Lightfoot, where you redesigned the Pet and kept making it for six more years. Would there be a Lightfoot if the Pet project hadn't come around?
That's a very good question. We're actually out in a very rural area in the Rocky Mountains.
Right.
And we looked around and said, what resources do we have to be in this area? I moved here when I met Marty, who became my wife, and we wanted to stay in this area. And we evaluated our resources, our abilities, our capabilities, our passions, and this is what we came up with.
Okay, that's fascinating. I watched a short video, The Gift of Mobility People, have up at your website, and I saw that in the boxes that they send the trikes out with, that they stuff them with secondhand clothing and even old tennis balls and things like that. Do they still do that?
Yes. That's the way they go out. As much useful secondhand stuff as we can find goes out with these cycles.
Wow. So here you've got an operation now. It's a for-profit operation. We got to cut every corner possible, especially in present-day economy. Was that a kind of a hard transition for you to make?
Well, we did transition into making the cycles, and it was a couple years before we actually developed a market and before we started to be really happy with our designs. The first ones, when I looked back on them, when I encounter one today, I believe that most of them, even from the early days, are still out there and operating. And when I see one, I sort of am taken aback and go, whoa, that was pretty crude. But it's still working, it's still functioning, and it did for its owner what we intended it to do, to be a safe, comfortable, useful cycle. Making the transition was difficult. We struggled for a lot of years.
Wow. Okay. Well, when you made that shift, all of a sudden you had to market. You had to create a product line. You had to design for a finicky marketplace. What did you learn during that time?
Well, that's a very big question. One of the things that happened to us after the first, I'd say, 3 or 4 years of essentially building one or two models and learning what it was all about, we didn't have a lot to go on. A lot of what we developed from scratch. The first couple years, we struggled. Every model that we made, essentially a bike and a trike. And then each of these became more refined, and then as we understood better the mechanics, the ergonomics, aerodynamics, how to build the characteristics and features and qualities into the cycle that we wanted, the bike split into two different models and then split again into four different models. The trike did the same thing. It was after a couple of these generations of innovation and refinement that we started getting to the point where we thought we really had a product that we could go regionally or even nationally with. And of course, in hindsight, looking back at those, they still seemed crude. They weren't up to our standards of today by any means. Mm-hmm. But we were still very steep on the learning curve. And it was at that time that we started to use the growing internet and found ourselves developing with the internet. So essentially, The growth of the internet, the start and the growth of the internet, made our position as a national business possible. Otherwise, here in Montana, not having a populous metropolitan base in which to sell our things, we had to go national, and we depended absolutely on the internet.
Indeed.
And at this time, our major presence is on the internet.
Did I do your first website? Do you remember?
Excuse me?
Did I do your first website back in 96, I think it was?
I'm really not sure.
I kind of think I did. Anyway, we talked here a few weeks ago with Tim Romer of Lightning and Cycle, and he's kind of like you in the sense he bases his operation out of the Paso Robles, that's off the beaten path. And he found that, he's 150 miles away from raw materials, suppliers, and the like, at least he's got an Air Force base nearby where he's got fellow engineers he can access as a way to add to his mental power. But you're in Montana. How do you get around your remoteness? How do you access some of the high-tech things you need out there?
Well, that also is a good question. And again, this is the result of growing with the internet and our ability to over the years, access more and more information via the internet has been extremely important to us. I was a long ago member, back when I was young and shiny faced, of the International Human Powered Vehicle Association. And I maintained that status for quite a long time. We relied a lot on my father with our technical questions, but because of the distance, he's in Missouri, we did a lot of this without him. Other resources include the Montana State University Technology Center in Butte, Montana, and their engineers there, as well as the Montana Manufacturers Extension Center and the consulting engineers that we've used there for some time.
So, essentially then, how far, for example, are you from Butte?
In Montana, some people measure things by six-packs. but
okay.
I don't. We're about 3 hours.
3 hours.
Okay. By car.
Okay. Yeah. So the closest, what's the population of, what's your city? I keep forgetting the name of that.
We're in Darby, which is population of not much over 1,500 people.
Okay.
And the closest metropolitan type town is Missoula, population about 70,000.
Isn't that also where Robert Persick was a professor? The author of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. It seems to me he was either there or at Montana State.
Well, I can't tell you that, but I can tell you that Missoula has been, for quite some time, a bit of a bicycling mecca, and the national organization Adventure Cycling is based there.
Exactly, yes, correct. Okay.
I also worked with the bicycle and pedestrian office there when I was going to college, and at that time they were pretty progressive for a town of that size.
Wow. So what is your like closest I'm here, as you know, in Ireland right now, and my dad had a funny joke for me the other day. He said, hey, do you know what happened to why they closed the library in Ireland? And I said, okay, well, why, Dad? He said, someone stole the book. Which I thought was pretty funny. Do you have hardware stores? Do you have libraries? Do you have, there in your small little town of 1,500 people, I mean, what if you need to go out real quick and grab something that you need for like a fix or something you're working on your bike?
No, we don't have much of that. It's improved a little bit here in the last few years.
Yeah.
But what we do have is UPS service, and we have courier service, daily courier service from Missoula, which is 75 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's helped out a tremendous amount. Without those two services, we wouldn't be here.
Wow. And without the internet, obviously, it sounds like what I'm hearing. You make some incredibly amazing bikes. You make like fully enclosed bikes. You make bikes with rack and pinion front ends. You make 2, 3, and 4 wheelers. You know, before we get into that, too much of that, where does all this amazement come from? Or let me back, say it differently before I get to that. What's your background, Rod?
Well, my background is essentially that of working with my father, initially on what was called the TRAG program. T-R-A-G is an acronym that stands for Transportation for Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And that program preceded the PET project. The TRAG was a powered 5 or 8 horsepower engine that powered this quarter ton truck, but much more than just a truck. It was designed for being used by small farmers and small commercial operations in the developing world. Mm-hmm. Again, a very sturdy, very simple, very plain, yet highly capable vehicle. And it was working on that project that I developed most of my ability to see the design relationships in a vehicle and to understand the basics of how one goes about manufacturing these, especially at a small scale.
Hmm. Okay. How about college? I think you mentioned that you went to college in Missoula.
I went to college in Missouri, Southwest Missouri okay. State University,
okay.
In general studies, and I studied the economics of energy at the University of Montana in Missoula.
Huh. So do you have a degree from both those places? Or?
If I put them together, I should have had, but I actually went to Peru in what would have been my last year of college to start a TRAG factory Peru, and
wow.
Never got it finished.
Wow, that's amazing. You at Lightfoot, how many different bikes are you making now? How many different models do you make at Lightfoot?
Well, that's a very good question. Some days it seems like almost nothing that goes out the door is identical to anything else that's gone out the door.
Yeah.
But we do have about 5 base models of bike and about 8 base models of trike. And although much of what goes out of our door is customized to some extent, more and more the customization that we have done is being reduced to a module that we have done, let's say, 6 times. We're pretty good at making it, and we can actually call it an option because it's something that a number of people have voted for with their dollars. Said this is a feature I would like to have. So a lot of adaptations for special needs and a lot of adaptations for special applications. Somebody wants to haul their kayak on top of their trike. Somebody wants to carry a cargo of bread that they deliver on a daily basis on a trike. Those kind of things, on almost, I would say, 2/3 of the cycles that we send out, you have this underlying base model, and then you have this mild or dramatic customization to it.
So is that pretty much kind of the underpin? When people come to buy from Lightfoot, they get a feeling for the fact that, well, I want to buy your bike because I can customize it. I can do things beyond just how it shows up in the catalog.
That has been a niche for us because of some of the restrictions we have being out here in the country, because of the fact that we're using a made-in-America labor for everything. In order to compete with some of the larger manufacturers, we have to offer this kind of customization.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten fairly good at it. And I think this year is a turning point. As you may know, we are moving to a new facility, and that is actually happening and starting today. It's the first full day of spring in 2011, and all of my crew are over at the new facility this morning.
Wow.
And what we are embarking on is a new phase in Lightfoot Cycles, and with a focus on increased efficiency in manufacture, probably the customization is going to happen in a separate facility, in a separate shop. But we're going to continue to offer that. But I think that it's going to become less frequent, and we're going to be selling a lot more cycles. They're not necessarily cookie cutter, but they have a lot less options. And it appears as though by the end of this year, we should have a handful of dealers, and people should be able to now buy Lightfoot cycles, not just direct from the factory, as always has been the case, but very soon from dealers.
Well, I want to come back to that. But before we get there, I want you to tell us about that four-wheel bike you make that can climb logs and pretty much go anywhere.
Well, the models that we have all exist because they address a certain function. And one of the functions that we address is that is addressed in the larger mechanized engine-assisted or engine-powered world by the modern ATV. Back when I was younger, there were a few little three-wheel ATV trikes running around. And nowadays, the four-wheel ATV made by Yamaha and Polaris and all these people is ubiquitous on the rural landscape. Everybody uses them. There's a reason for that. They're small, they're agile, they don't cost much to drive across your pasture or across your ranch. They'll negotiate snow, mud, things like this. It wasn't our intent when we built the first ATC, all-terrain cycle, to replicate, or certainly not to compete with the modern ATV. But the application is very similar, the difference being that this is a much lighter, much less resource-intensive, human-powered vehicle. But it has the same capabilities of being able to be ridden across pastures, across fields, through the woods. And if you want to take it on an adventure, it'll do that as well. We have two people that we're talking to at the moment. One wants to lead Outback adventures in Australia on a fleet of ATCs. And we have another guy who wants to follow the trail of the Donner Party through the Sierra on an ATC.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Now, this you're calling it an ATC, all-terrain cycle, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, this ATC, this is the one with the rack and pinion steering?
Well, actually, it acts like rack and pinion steering, but it's not exactly. It's something that I've never seen before, the way that we use it with, I'm not even sure how to describe it, but if you looked at one closely, you would see that it has some linkages that act in a very unconventional way, and an articulating front end that rotates around the long axis of the cycle, allowing the two pairs of wheels, the front and rear wheels, to move relative to each other to accommodate unevenness in a terrain. Normally with a four-wheel cycle, you either have to include some form of suspension like you do on a Jeep or a Humvee in order to adapt to uneven terrain, or you go with a tricycle that, because of its tripod stance, always can find distributed footing on any terrain. But the tricycle is not nearly as stable as a four-wheeler, so this is why the two articulated pairs of wheels.
Tell us about the recumbent two-wheeler you make. Excuse me, not recumbent, the recumbent two-wheel mountain bike you make.
both the ATC, all-terrain cycle, and our Bigfoot cycle utilize the 4-inch tires and the wheels that were developed originally for use in snow. The Snowcat and other designs like this that originated in Alaska, allowing people to ride in the snow, have become an established product. And several different mountain bikes are made with these super fat tires. When we put them on the ATC, it magnifies the capabilities of the ATC. And when we put one on our Ranger bicycle, which was designed specifically to function as a more off-road capable recumbent, it transformed the Ranger even further and made it that much more capable. The fat tires allow us to travel over some snow, over some mud, to travel across a grassy meadow without leaving a rut, both increasing the capability and lowering the impact of riding off-road. And we have ridden them through the woods and fields and along dirt roads here in Montana, and it's a very capable design. It's the Bigfoot version of our Ranger bicycle.
Okay, Rod, you've ridden a mountain bike, I'm sure, right? A regular mountain bike?
Oh, yeah.
How does your Ranger, your two-wheel recumbent mountain bike size, compare? How does it size up compared to a regular two-wheel mountain bike?
Well, the Ranger can do a lot of things that a regular mountain bike does, or what you want a regular mountain bike to do. What it does not do nearly as well are the things that the modern, highly suspended downhill bike is capable of doing. A regular mountain bike, especially in the suspended version, is very quick, very maneuverable. You can take it off of jumps. You can bunny hop up onto a picnic table and off the other side. These are things that the Ranger is not designed to do. The Ranger is designed to go to travel cross country and to keep you stable and comfortable and safe. I can descend very steeply on a Ranger, much more steeply than on an upright mountain bike. There are daredevils who would descend faster and more steeply than I, and they probably have the broken collarbones to prove it. But the Ranger is meant to go cross-country. Its long wheelbase soaks up the bumps and unevennesses of rough terrain. It keeps you in a face-forward, head-up position where you can see what you're traveling through. You're not looking at your front wheel, and it does that very well.
Awesome. Where does all this creativity come from, Rod? I mean, this things like this, designing a bike like this, and all the other kinds of designs that you've got in under the Lightfoot cycle roof. Does this stuff wake you up at night?
Well, I'm sorry to say that I'm probably genetically doomed to do this. I see in myself my own father, and I see him sitting in his chair late at night with his pencil and paper, coming up with ideas. And who knew that that could be genetically determined? For a lot of years, I tried to escape and not be that.
Right.
But then I found myself being that, and it's okay.
Uh-huh.
So there's that genetic component. And then secondarily, there's an intellectual component. When I studied energy economics, and this has been a long time ago now, it became obvious to me that our society and our technology is underpinned by the availability of easily found and easily converted energy sources. And it also became apparent to me in my studies of geomorphology and geology and things like that, that the supplies of energy that we were taking from stored domains in the soil, in the earth, in the rocks, were not inexhaustible.
Mm-hmm.
That energy would need to have applied to it the same innovation that we apply to everything else. And part of me was confident that we are innovative enough and intelligent enough to both recognize the need for it and to put our energy in our personal psychic energy into creating new forms and new types of energy. At the same time, I know that we humans do make mistakes at times. We do find ourselves engaged in war. We do find ourselves engaged in battles for resources, and we do find ourselves sometimes at the mercy of economic slowdowns and things like this. It appeared to me that there were some very good reasons for pursuing energy efficiency, especially in transportation. And my little contribution, the little piece of the puzzle, is for urban and individual transportation to create highly capable, highly efficient forms of transportation, the kind of thing that you can rely on, a very reliable, very safe, highly usable transportation. And then we are going to have to let humanity choose these forms when it makes sense for them. In another a part of the Venn diagram that describes what it is we're doing, we of course have the adaptability component, and that is a relic perhaps of my work with people in the PET project who mm-hmm. don't have full mobility,
right.
And we would like that kind of mobility to be represented in our design. So we design that as a plug-in. And the utility of the cycles, if you're going to walk out to your garage and look at the car and look at your bicycle or your velomobile or your trike and make a decision, am I going to work today? Am I going to the store? Am I going to use this car, this 3,000-pound, 20-mile-a-gallon car, or am I going to use this tricycle? We believe that people are going to make the right decision for themselves most of the time, almost all of the time. And the final aspect is that we all need exercise. It should be pretty darn apparent to everybody by now that the human animal needs exercise for health. The epidemic of obesity in our country, I think it's really all the proof that we need. And yes, you may get helmet hair. Yes, you may be a little more fragrant at work than you would like to be if you sweated to get there, but you're going to be healthier for it. So all of these things provide me with the emotional energy to continue pursuing this. It's good for society as a whole. It's good for the environment. It's good for the individual who needs it for mobility, who needs it for transportation, who needs it perhaps simply to get exercise. And if they have fun doing it, yay. It's good for that, too.
That's so wonderful to hear. Someone who's pure, who's kept his purity, you know, about why he's in business. And yet, here now you've got the state of Montana that they've taken an interest in you and in your business. And as a result, you and your wife, Marty, are ratcheting things up for an exciting expansion you touched on earlier. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I've heard rumors that Cannondale started in a horse barn, and so did Lightfoot Cycles. And it was one of the resources that we had available to us. So we kicked the horses out and we converted this barn, and that's where we got our start.
Mm-hmm.
And we are just now moving to a new facility. It's happening this week. We will have more capability. We will have a showroom. We will be able to function as a destination for people who want to stop by and visit, who want to join us on group rides. We have three group rides scheduled for the year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to allow us to really pursue, in concert with the recommendations of the Montana Manufacturers Extension Center and our consulting engineer, to pursue a increasingly efficient form of manufacture. We are going to build in the margins that are needed for us to be able to distribute through dealerships. And with a little bit of luck, over time, we'll keep whittling away at our prices, making our cycles increasingly affordable for people.
Mm-hmm. Do you foresee, Rock, where you're still going to be able to keep the customization component available to your customers?
Yes. We actually have sketched out a customization shop where our standard or base model cycles will go through the manufacturing process. And when we get a customization request, we simply reach into that process and pluck out a frame, make the modifications in our custom shop,
mm-hmm.
and then reinsert it into the flow where it will be.
Wow.
It'll continue along until final assembly, at which time we pluck it out again and take it next door to the custom shop where it's customized and then sent back to shipping. So, yes, we think we're going to be able to continue doing that.
How big of a part does Marty play in your business?
Marty is absolutely essential. They say that two heads are better than one, and sometimes with her help, synergistically combining with mine, I would mm-hmm. say it feels like three brains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We call her the Commissioner of Common Sense.
Okay.
And when we get too far out of left field with our flights of fancy, she mm-hmm. brings us back.
Yeah.
She's been incredibly important, even though I am the major designer,
mm-hmm.
as far as creating the business, we're mm-hmm. equal partners.
Yeah. Every time over the years, probably over the last decade and a half or so, I've talked to Marty a lot, and she seems like she's totally interwoven into the business, and I mean, that's just awesome. I think that's fantastic. It really is awesome stuff. Well, listen, Rod, it's been great talking to you. I really feel honored and blessed with the time you've taken today. Is there anything that you'd like to add?
Well, I'm very glad that we had this conversation, and I hope that you continue doing this. I hope it is a tool for education, and we're glad to talk to anybody who wants to follow up on this. Just contact Lightfoot Cycles in Darby, Montana. Look at our website, and we'd be glad to answer any questions that were stirred up by this.
Well, just let me follow that last thought up with this, and then I'll let you run back to your new building, no less. But it's funny how, like, one of the reasons that I found it almost important for me to be doing this podcast series is because of people like you. People, we need to be able for posterity, for the archive of our mental trust, if you will, to be able to take some of the accomplishments, not some of them, I mean, major things that people like yourself have done that aren't always in the headlines, but just make a huge contribution. We need to be saving this stuff. You know, we need to be finding out so other people can learn from people like you as they go down the pike with where your success came from and why you did things the way you did them and So,
I think that's extremely valuable. I think it was Harry Truman, and I'll paraphrase, who said that there's nothing new on Earth, really, except for history that you don't know yet.
I like that. That's very, very good. All right, Rod. Well, listen, it's been awesome talking to you. It really has. As usual and always, I feel blessed, and I hope people out there are able to see the brilliant man behind Lightfoot Cycles and the articulate spokesperson for all things good. So thanks, Rod. It's been great talking to you. We'll talk soon.
Okay. Take care, Mark.
All right, man. See you later, Rod. Bye.
Okay. Bye now.
That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. To access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.